Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory. Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Brian Ballow.
I'm Nathan Connolly.
And I'm Joanne Freeman. Each week, along with our colleague Ed Ayers, we explore a different part of American history. And normally it's fair game for us to span across centuries and dive into everything from George Washington to Watergate. But on this episode, we're going to be keeping our timeline a bit more concise. As the calendar nears closer to the end of 2019, it has us reflecting on the end of the decade and how the United States has changed since the start of the 2010s. So on this episode, we're bringing you an extended conversation between Brian, Nathan, and myself about the memorable moments of the last 10 years.
But before we kick off our discussion, let's do a quick recap of the decade. Back in 2010, Barack Obama was still in the beginning of his first term. Meanwhile, Americans were recovering from the fallout of the Great Recession, an economic collapse many folks still feel the effects of today.
2 years later, the country was shaken to its core after the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. Debates about gun control ramped up after the tragedy. Nevertheless, mass shootings continue to plague the United States.
By the middle of the decade, social unrest reached a boiling point after the deaths of young Black men like Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown. The movement Black Lives Matter formed, sparking a national conversation about systemic racism and racial violence.
The 2010s also had its fair share of landmark legal cases. For example, in 2015, the Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage across the country.
And then came 2016. An extremely contentious presidential race divided the nation between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Clinton made history as the first woman to be the nominee for a major party. And as we know, Donald Trump won the election with his mantra, "Make America Great Again." There's a lot that happened since Trump took office. But for the sake of time, let's jump forward to the present day. The United States is gearing up for another race in 2020, while Trump faces an impeachment probe for allegedly abusing his power.
Now keep in mind, this is all just a snapshot of the decade. There's plenty more we'll get to in our discussion. So, Brian, Joanne, ready to recap the 2010s?
Ready to go.
Terrific. All right, let's just start with the biggest question that we can think of. How will history remember this decade?
So my initial feeling in light of its cultural and political power is they're going to remember this as a decade of social media, as a decade of connectivity, as a decade where people were figuring out who their friends and enemies were at the click of a mouse. It feels to me, at least, that the last 10 years, Facebook, Twitter, any number of apps, really did determine how we related to each other in the most basic human terms.
Sounds like a good answer. And I agree with everything you said, although I would encompass that in, I think, an even larger generalization. And that's, we're going to remember this decade as the decade that America really struggled with exceptionalism, a really, really old concept among historians. Just to put a little meat on the bones, I would say that we had a president in Barack Obama whose policies were universalistic, were internationalistic, but who embraced good old American norms and concepts of how to do politics that had been in place, well, certainly for a big part of the previous century. And I defer to you, Joanne, but I would say for much of American history. Then we got a president who embraced nationalism very explicitly, pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. Yet he embraced a kind of politics that was familiar all over the world, especially in authoritarian regimes, with America becoming much less exceptional. So to me, that social media that you talked about, Nathan, is a very important part of the story, but I'm going big here.
So my assumption of how we're going to remember the decade has largely to do with, this kind of echoes what you said, Nathan, how people are connected to each other and how people are disconnected from each other in different ways. And some of that is technology, the different ways we have access to each other, the different kinds of conversations that have been happening because of technology, basically. And because of that, also the ways in which we've disconnected from each other in some ways. But the way in which I connect this to the bigger picture of what Brian was saying is, I think in many ways the fate of democracy is tied in with the question of connectivity. And so I think the next decade certainly is going to be a really interesting decade as to how shifts in how we connect with each other are going to be shaping our politics with each other.
Let's drill down a little bit, and we're going to get methodological here. Why are we even talking about decades? I mean, as historians, do we really want to take that unit, the decade, seriously? Why should we even waste our time talking about this unit?
That's how we think, not as historians, but as people. We look for anniversaries and stopping points and starting points. And the goofy aspect of this is the number changes, which signals that there's been some change that has happened, regardless of the fact that 2019 and 2020 will not be divided in any great dramatic way. But in the same way that we're always looking for our own personal anniversaries and anniversaries of everything else, it seems to connote the changing of time in a really visible way that I guess we don't often see.
Yeah, no, I mean, and we behave in accordance with that norm. I mean, I think about the census as this great, you know, marker of the passage of time, and you're taking stock of your population, of resources, the distribution of a number of things. And then you also have, you know, as we all began in this, you know, craft ages ago as, you know, students in elementary schools, the timeline across the upper rim of the classroom going around the wall, right? It's like you mark time in these decades, and we think about the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. And one of my favorite things about, you know, historians is that we always want to complicate things until it comes time to teach something. Then we're all about simplifying. And we all know when you come time to structure that lecture, that conversation, that explanation, the decades come creeping right back into, you know, the way that we think we ought to know better. And so, you know, in some ways, we have to just kind of acknowledge that muscle memory that we have and say that, you know, this is as good a time as any, frankly, to take stock of what's going on.
Another kind of methodological question, should we really be summing up this decade before it's even over?
So, you know, I think this is a really fair and important question. If for no other reason, you know, we know when we do an assessment of a period, an event, a moment, a person, we like to have multiple perspectives. And I fear that one of the things that can happen when you try to take stock of a decade, frankly, while we're still in that decade, is we're relying on that first draft. We're relying on journalists and bloggers and the kind of hot takes of pundits. And it might well be an entirely different conclusion that we would reach if we take a moment and say, you know what, maybe the 2010s, 40 years from now, means something very different than what it meant at the time. I mean, I think about, you know, for example, you know, in the 1890s, people thought that the world was coming off its axis, right? You have this emergence of mass-produced electricity. You have these World Columbian Expositions. You have people believing that it's the end of this, you know, Victorian era, and the entire world is going to change in ways that were, you know, completely fundamental. Mm-hmm. And some things did change, but a lot of things didn't change. I mean, there was a century of still massive wealth inequality. We talk now about a second Gilded Age, you know, in hearkening back. And so in some ways, I wonder if our sense of novelty about 2010s, even on the question of, you know, connectivity and computing, you know, is actually something that's a little bit less novel.
Well, but you know, so that, I totally agree with what you're saying, but in a way, that's a perfect segue into what we do so well, ideally, as historians, not so much finding novelty, but finding patterns.
Right.
I think it is possible, as historians or not, to look at a chunk of time and recognize patterns that are unfolding that seem related and that suggest something. And I thought about this a lot over the course of the last decade. There are moments where, you know, I would stand back and say, wow, history is unfolding, you know? This is a historic event. And then my historian brain would say, Joanne, that is an unsophisticated thought. History is always unfolding, you know?
So name your favorite one of those moments.
Okay. Well, one of my sort of amazing history is unfolding moments was back in 2016 when there was a debate over gun control in the House, and that House called a recess so the cameras would be turned off. And there were still speechifying going on in the House. And to broadcast that to the nation, members of Congress pulled out their cell phones.
Wow.
And they were live streaming
Wow.
what they were saying in the House chamber. And that stunned me. I actually just sat in front of my TV screen watching, actually my computer, watching that, because it represented this concrete moment when one form of technology just said to another, see ya. We're connecting with the American public in a more direct way. Now, that was before we fully recognized the power of the tweet. And now we've moved on to other forms of connection between politicians and the public. But the fact that those members of Congress said, okay, we don't really need structured, institutionalized media. Here, I have this thing in my pocket. That was stunning to me because technology changing not just the way we connect to each other, but fundamentally changing our politics, that's one of the big, big things about this decade that really stands out to me. And that cell phone moment was kind of a smack in the face reality factor of it.
So I'm going to get away from politics and I'm going to reinforce your point about connectivity, because I do absolutely agree that one of the things that changed most dramatically over the last almost 10 years is the way we connect to each other. And I'm going to give you a very specific example that affected my life. I think you guys know that my three kids are adopted, and they have been in touch with birth parents, but their actual identity until they chose, for instance, to meet with a birth parent, which not all of them have done, remained anonymous. In other words, their birth parents didn't necessarily know where they lived. When Facebook changed its privacy settings in a pretty universal way at the very beginning of the decade, two out of my three kids were contacted directly by a birth parent. Maybe I'm making too much of a personal anecdote, but I think this is a decade because of the ways in which we were changing connections and disconnections. A lot of issues that perhaps were legislated or talked about rhetorically really sunk down to the social level, the person-to-person level. I think that's true of race. I think that's true of gender. I'm struggling for the words here, but there was a kind of mass and visceral sense of reordering the way we connect to each other, right down to the family level in my example.
I mean, again, this is one of those moments where there's no arguing about the power that this new media has had on our lives and relationships. But there's also that old world creeping right back in. And I'll give you my favorite example. I mean, in response to the question of historic moments, mine is actually one that falls outside of the clean decade parameter. And it's the election of Barack Obama as a moment that I saw as history unfolding, and obviously his presidency then comes to define much of the decade that follows. But to the point around media and connectivity, there are 330 million, apparently, monthly subscribers on Twitter. 330 million. A lot of people. The person who has a full third of those followers is Barack Obama. 110 million followers Now, that tells me something that I think is really powerful, right, is that you have this incredible new technology, this hyper-connectivity, and yet you still have this old hierarchy where, you know, the leader of the free digital world, I suppose, is still Barack Obama. I mean, far eclipsing even President Trump's Twitter followers by a considerable order of magnitude. And that just says a lot about the way in which we still gravitate toward centers of celebrity, centers of power, the people who we feel compelled to follow and watch and from whose lives we still mark time, I think is a very powerful connector to an earlier period before the decade arises with all of its, you know, novelty, right? Is that there's still something that's important, to your point, Brian, about presidents and their cultural power.
Temperature is personal. Everyone's idea of comfortable is unique. And that's certainly true with me. I will confess I'm the kind of person who's constantly opening up windows wherever I am because I want it to be cooler than it is. And the Ember Wave helped with that. Not feeling thermally comfortable can contribute to lost productivity, increased stress levels, and it can be mentally exhausting. Ember Wave is there when you need relief most. All you do is press to activate Ember Wave for a burst of heating or cooling. This sensation pairs with your body and mind to make you feel more comfortable in a matter of minutes. Invented by 3 MIT scientists, Ember Wave was named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018 and has been reviewed by a number of leading technical publications like Wired, Fast Company, and GMA. Listeners will get $30 off if they go to emberwave.com/backstory. That's emberwave.com/backstory.
So, Joanne, what's a big theme within this decade that you want to bring our attention to?
Well, in my coasting around, right, in my thinking about this show and thinking, what are the things I want to say, and Googling around as one does, I found that in 2016, the American Dialect Society named their word of the year, and it was they, a singular genderless pronoun. That in this decade received all kinds of new meanings and definitions, and people own their gender and define their gender in all kinds of different ways. They're public about the implications of either their gender or someone else's gender in all kinds of interesting ways. You have the Me Too movement. You have this working its way into politics and culture in a very public way. So I think on a personal level and a broader social and political level, gender and sexuality and the implications of those things has been a major theme.
I would completely agree. And again, it's a matter, as you say, that is both political and cultural. It's in people's families and how they elect to construct those families. And it's a question of, again, what's the future of human relationships and democracy, right? Are we going to be able to, in some ways, retrofit our various national projects and, you know, political systems to allow for they in the way that we are now talking about it? When you first said it, I thought about the Cold War and the us versus them and that old kind of adversarial, you know, old tone. But this is an entirely different and affirming use of the term. I mean, even the idea that there's a they that is more than one, it's actually taken on a meaning in its base tone that is very different from an us versus them 20th century use of the plural pronoun.
Well, we could probably talk about 15 more themes that no doubt will define our decade. But as historians, you know, we do tend to think in comparative terms. So I'd be curious to hear from each of you whether there are any decades that spring to mind when you're defining the 2010s. What decade does it seem most like? A lot of people, for instance, say the 1960s.
There are two things that jump out to me that I think are really worth thinking about. The first is actually a point of comparison, but the other is actually a sharp contrast to the 60s. And I'll start with the contrast, which is to say that during the 1960s into the 1970s, there was, it's felt to me at least, a much stronger sense of the fact that the country was at war. And what that meant in the way that the news unfolded, in the way that protests played out, in the way that people were divided along lines of being, you know, pro or anti-war protesters. And we're in a moment now where we're actually engaged in a larger military conflict for a much longer period of time. But the nature of that conflict, call it the war on terror, call it, you know, pacification, call it the drone war. But it's remarkable to me to see the sharp difference between how we think about and talk about war on a daily basis, even though the country is engaged in a protracted military conflict. And that's, to me, a really sharp point of contrast. The point of comparison that feels very strong is about the domestic question, and particularly on the question of racial justice, where you have, you know, a 50-year period where people believed that we could institutionalize multiculturalism. And we thought that that was going to kind of carry us forward after the 1960s. And we are now seeing a real rebuttal against that belief, right? Whether you're talking about what's going on with white nationalism and direct action in the kind of alt-right and what we saw in Charlottesville as a site of very dramatic white nationalism, or looking at a movement like Black Lives Matter that is raising a really profound critique about how our political process is still being relatively unresponsive to the lingering and ongoing problem of trenchant poverty, police brutality, you know, and so forth. And so it's a very sharp moment of overlap with the 1960s period that is raising many of the same kinds of concerns about race and national belonging. And it's no accident that we have a political movement within party politics that feels in a lot of ways it wants to turn back the clock to a pre-1960s period in a lot of ways. I think that to me is another really effective piece of evidence about the importance of that decade for marking where we are now.
Very convincing. Joanne, did they have decades in the 18th century?
They did have decades in the 18th century, but there actually is an 18th century decade I want to bring in. Want to kind of build off of what Nathan just said. I'm going to add two decades in because I think that there are, like the 1960s and like the present, that there have been not necessarily decades, but certainly moments in the past. I mean, change is constant, but there are moments when the way that things are or are not changing feels – I always grope for words about this. I've called them to myself pathway moments or moments when there's something major being decided, and civil rights and social justice in the 1960s, that was where that was being really fully debated in public aggressively in a way it hadn't been before. In the 1850s, I think, was another one of those moments, echoes of the present in many ways. The issue then obviously was slavery. You go back further in time and you talk about the 1790s and particularly the late 1790s when the big issue under debate was, what does democracy really mean? How does it work?
Right.
How does it play out?
Right.
So if you look at first this extreme changing moment centered on democracy and then one centered on slavery and then one centered on social justice and civil rights, and now in some ways among the things that we're focused on is citizenship. And what that means, and who gets to be a citizen, and what rights does citizenship entail, it kind of, when you look from that very obviously historian-esque view of American history, it makes it very logical that some of what we're experiencing at this moment is happening with a major issue like that under debate.
So I'm going to run the risk of suggesting that our decade is really reflective of all of American history by adding another decade. My decade is the 1890s. I believe that Nathan referred to the Gilded Age earlier in the conversation, and it's a decade I would point to where Americans were as class conscious as they were going to be across American history, perhaps with the exception of the low point of the Great Depression in the 1930s. But certainly politically, these views were articulated by two very contrasting approaches, and they broke down, not entirely, but in many ways along the urban-rural divide, another theme that's very similar to our politics. There was a genuine populism. The populist movement, when people talk about populism today, they're often referring back to the populist movement of the 1890s among farmers. They wanted to think of themselves as producers, but in fact, they never really won over the urban working class as much as they would have liked. But they did really challenge what today we would call the 1%. And I think you can find the analogs of that populism both on the left in the 2010s in Occupy Wall Street, and the incredible success of candidates like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders on the left. And I think you can find the inverse use of populism in the Tea Party that kicked off the decade we're talking about, in the Freedom Caucus, and a right-wing populism that one can find in Trump's campaign to make America great again.
So, Nathan Bryan, I have one thought about something that really came into its own in this decade that I really feel a compelling need to raise with you in particular. This has also in many ways been a decade of the podcast coming into its own, hasn't it?
I think that's a great point about content and entertainment and information, democracy, but also
connection, you
know, connection and inundation. Right. I mean, I don't know where we are now with the current count. I feel like it might have been 6 months ago where the count of podcasts was somewhere in the neighborhood of 400,000 different podcasts, and it may well have doubled by now. It's a powerful marker of what we would call kind of disaggregating of audiences, and people are just getting their content in very, you know, specific ways. And I wonder if there's a future of podcasting that is going to be more about consolidating again. But right now it feels like a giant scattering of people's listening content.
That's going to do it for us today, but you can keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought of the episode or ask us your questions about history. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio.
Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.